wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, part two of Bill Resnick's conversation with Harry Fetter about the radical right's attack on public schools, as well as part two of a reading by Celilo YM activist Lana Jack. We'll also hear from Norm Diamond, his review of the Portland Center Stage performance of Midsummer Night's Dream, and a dance performance by the Northwest Dance Project. And from the archives, book mole Larry Bolden reviews The Taste of Ginger. First up, Bill Resnick talks to Harry Fetter about how the radical right's attacks on public schools are succeeding, especially with regards to racism, sex ed, and U.S. history. Part 1 aired last month on May 15. Search for that at kboo.fm. Here's Bill Resnick speaking with Harry Fetter for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Harry Fetter, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be here.
Harry Fetter practiced law for about 10 years before realizing he would rather teach, in which he quickly became critical of high-stakes testing, which he realized forced teaching in schools to teach to the test, which treats students as vessels to hold facts rather than be active learners, in which they take on meaningful projects and identify them and in their activity. They're themselves building their skills. That's as Harry and many of his colleagues did successfully in their teaching. And then developed the organization Fair Test, and Harry worked in it, and he became its director, as he remains today. For the last several years, Harry has been watching the development of the radical right's attack on public education, and he's just back from a conference of educational journalists who discussed, among many other subjects, the current radical right-wing attack on the public schools and their curriculums. So, Harry, analyze for us that right-wing attack, and then we can discuss what those committed to critical education, not indoctrination by the right wing, can do to blunt the attack and ultimately defeat the hard and often lunatic right.
Well, Bill, certainly for journalists, one of their, if not their principal area of interest in their coverage these days is the, what I would call the politicization of local education and things like curriculum and what teachers should be teaching, this whole sort of anti-woke mantra, anti-critical race theory, also backlash surrounding issues of gender and whether or not students should be engaged in, not just engaged in gender studies, but sort of free to express their own gender identity. And, you know, this is part of a larger movement, I would say, toward and the idea of parental control towards privatization and really the undermining of public education. We see this through the voucher movement, which has gained new currency in state houses around the country. And these are not vouchers just to sort of try to do something different for public schools in inner cities that didn't work, as the original voucher programs in or Milwaukee, which were far from resounding successes. And the research on the impact of vouchers is pretty clearly negative. And for you listeners out there, I would recommend the work of Josh Cowan at Michigan State. But now it is the idea that people, parents should be able to decide where their kids go to school, and the government should sort of pay and subsidize those decisions, even when a parent is already sending their kid to private school and has made that decision. So there isn't really an equity element here. It's really just about choice. And when you have untrammeled free choice about what to do with your kid, what you don't have is any kind of recognition of the public mission of education to create a citizenry, a democratic citizenry that can engage in critical discussion, that can talk to one another when they disagree, that can learn about a variety of viewpoints, about a variety of things, that can be trained in sort of deeper thinking and learning and understand how to solve problems. And when you go into like the STEM fields, to actually think about what the next problem is, as opposed to just, you know, learning things in a rote fashion. So that's the kind of attack that we see. And it's sort of based in politics. It's based in electoral politics. It's a plea to the right wing base of the Republican Party right now. But beyond that, it's just another chapter in a longstanding attack on public education. And of course, you know, attack on teachers, who are in many ways the embodiment of public education, because they're the ones who are actually doing it. So, you know, we heard a lot from at this conference. There was a session on this where there was a principal, I think from Pasadena, California, who spoke of the challenges that he faced being sort of caught in between two constituencies, if you will, a sort of more right-wing constituency. And then there were parents who really wanted the school to be more open and more tolerant of different people's viewpoints, to actually have history taught in a way that teaches about the truth and interpretations of different historical events, whether they speak highly of America or whether they speak less than highly of America. So there's a lot of discussion there. And I think, you know, from the Fair Test perspective, I think that what we are advocating for is systems of education that are tolerant of people's differences, and also that gets kids to really think deeply and critically about facts as they are presented. And it is the job of school to sort of create these critical democratic thinkers, and not to indoctrinate in any one particular worldview other than a worldview that recognizes difference and is tolerant of other people's viewpoints, but also gets kids the skills that they need to kind of argue about things as democratic citizens. And standardized testing is so far removed from that level of discourse that what it does is it creates schools as essentially, you know, kids wind up doing school as opposed to learning at school.
You know, Harry, one example I think that's so telling of many, many is the way they, Florida in particular, but it's now being copied all over the country and by the red state legislatures. And it goes beyond that. We can talk about that, how it's affected teachers everywhere, teachers, principals. As a principal from California discussed in his conference presentation, one of them is the way they dealt with critical race theory. It sort of vilifies it as teaching hatred of whites, which is a complete fabrication. Critical race theory actually appreciates the contribution in much of the work of critical race theorists, many of them with somewhat different ideas, and they're working them out. But the critical race theorists almost entirely appreciate the contribution of white abolitionists, and in fact, all the whites who have fought racism through the years, and then invite, in fact, the whites to join the anti-racist and pro-democracy movements, which I think is actually really successful in the United States. The great uprising around George Floyd and the murder of so many black men and women testifies. People like DeSantis are very, very worried about a black-white. In fact, it's the history of the United States is replete with this, of trying to kickbacks against whites and and with blacks, of course, the Reserve Army of Labor, often by poverty, forced to, in fact, break strikes by taking jobs so they can their families can eat for another year. And their attacks on LGBTI is so vicious and slanderous. Why is that radical right succeeding, though, in the schools?
Well, you're in the process of they're succeeding. I mean, I think they've created a lot of tension and a lot of heat. But I think that, you know, what you find is, at there are a lot of places around the country where in school board meetings, you know, parents are like, I just want my kids to learn math. I just want my kids to sort of know something about American history. I just want my kids to get the skills that they need to be able to succeed in college or in the workforce. So, you know, what are you doing here? You're kind of hijacking our meeting and our board and taking us in a direction that we don't necessarily want to go. And I would say that you're absolutely right about kind of race being a wedge that is used by currently the Republican Party. There was a time where the Democratic Party was the more racist party in America, in American politics, if you predate the 60s. And so what you're getting in this CRT business is, first of all, you know, there's a lot of untruths. I think if you like walked into your average classroom around America, they're not talking about quote unquote critical race theory. In their history classes, they may be talking about the slave experience. They may be talking about civil rights. They may be studying the idea that race is a critical element in American history and very much sort of explains a lot of American, the struggles over racial equality is a key element to American history, and that frequently the folks who were in power did not behave well or far from it, and that the struggles of black people are very reflective of the struggles of all Americans who haven't been in positions of power. But I think it's as they say, a false flag, even though it has politicized this stuff and basically it has people advocating for teaching untruths. And, you know, we don't want that. So I think that the bottom line here is that the politicization of this is an unfortunate element of current American politics that where the national politics has been brought local. And I think the way to fight it is by right-thinking parents at school board meetings sort of standing up for education that is rooted in critical thinking and examination of truth and, you know, just sort of the what we know to be the best of public education. And so I'm not sure how to like answer your question. This is a problem, and I think the problem needs to be fought with advocacy at the local level and with folks who are in education for standing up to what they know to be a more robust defense of public education as we would like to see it.
You know, I agree with you about the strategy. Certainly we need a ground game, parents organized, and in fact very convincing. The left has developed convincing refutation of all of the slanderous, vicious statements. But my sense is that if you read the progressive press and watch things, it creates a sense that the progressive side is able to match the intensity of the attack and, in fact, refute it.
Well, you know, defense is harder than offense, Bill.
Yeah, it sure is.
So I think that, you know, the position has to be just lay off the schools, right? I mean, if parents actually like what their schools are doing, they have to defend their schools.
You know, it's interesting in the United States. This is also true, in fact, of politics as a whole. Parents love their...
You like your school, but you don't like education. You like your congressman.
Yeah, right. Congress is broken. It doesn't work. But my guy, they're really pretty good. Yeah. My schools are pretty good. I like the teachers, but education is broken. Yeah, that should be.
But look, school boards are really like the kind of the first layer of democracy in America, right? It's like the most hyper-local of all things, right? It's that and your like town council and stuff like that. So, you know, what's unfortunate and, you know, what the right has perhaps done successfully is kind of nationalize the politics at the local level. And I think the way to combat that is to, you know, for people at the local level to say, you know, we're just not playing this game. We just want to make sure that our schools preserve the kind of, you know, liberal free thinking and academic rigor and social emotional learning for our kids. And, you know, also teach them good values of tolerance and how to be good people. So the bottom line is, from the FAIR test perspective, you know, we think that an education that is rooted in kind of learning by doing and kids really engaging with material and questioning and having discussion and having inquiry-based learning, and when they're doing a math problem, to think about what the hard non-routine problem would, how they could apply their knowledge from other things in science to do experiments, stuff like that, for them to engage in music and art and all the things that stimulate the mind, and not to be burdened excessively by standardized tests and standardized curriculum. That would also increase teacher professionalism. And I think that if you have a generation that are trained in this way, they will know to sort of pick apart and question the falsehoods that are being perpetuated by some on the right.
You know, Harry, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, authentic evaluation is what you're promoting, what FAIR test promotes. It requires schools that have authentic modes of learning where kids work on projects. And in fact, they build facts by doing and thinking about projects and examining and studying them and the problems that they face. And then doing reports and become able to both read about it and articulate it. That's an education. Assembling facts is just a apprenticeship for parlor games like Trivial Pursuits. Can you imagine that people engage in Trivial Pursuits? At any event, I can't. I know a lot of our listeners probably have been hooked into it, though. So, Harry, one last thing before we sign off today. Tell us about your organization, FAIR Test, and how to learn about FAIR Test and maybe contact you.
So FAIR Test, National Center for Fair and Open Testing, has been around since 1985. It was one of the loudest opponents to No Child Left Behind when No Child Left Behind was proposed and passed. It has been fighting against the misuse and excessive use of standardized tests and continues to do so. Our website is www.fairtest.org. We've got a lot of campaigns, public education campaigns. We are the repository of the list of schools that are test optional and test free for college admissions. We're working on trying to promote and help develop systems of performance-based assessments, which we think are both promote better kind of education in terms of what we would broadly call excellence and also in terms of equity. We're, of course, a not-for-profit and, you know, live by the grace of contributions from listeners like you. So we have lots of donate buttons on our website, and I encourage you to help us out, because all of this good advocacy type work does require a certain amount of resources. Although we are a lean, mean fighting machine, I will say. We tend to get interviewed and quoted in lots of articles that talk about testing. And so we have a voice, but we need that voice amplified.
Harry, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Anytime, Bill.
Keep up the good work.
Oh, I'm wondering. wonder why the world's so cold in the summertime.
Wondering Why by Professor Brian Oblivion. That followed Bill Resnick talking with Harry Fetter for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Radio. Again, you can find part one of that interview as part of the May 15, 2023 episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour. Search for that at kboo.fm. Up next, another part two. This time, we'll hear from Celilo YM activist Lana Jack reading from her memoir. Part one aired May 22nd. You can find that again at kboo.fm. Here's Lana Jack for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Our dad could have very well gone to prison over the salmon scam. My Atwai uncle, Chief Johnny Jumbo Jackson, at my brother's funeral, called my dad the infamous Percy Jack. He said, while everybody else had caught a case, your dad got away every time. Then he began to haul fish to his people in Lummi. We would have to sleep on a pile of salmon going down the road in our old station wagon, dripping slime all the way. And dad would say, smells like money. Because of the struggle for our fishing rights, my family was involved in the American Indian movement when I was 13. Running was my thing. In 1979, my mom, Mary Jack, helped organize a salmon spiritual walk run. The federal government didn't want to give us the right to harvest steelhead. So we protested. We ran from Celilo Park to Salem and then from Salem all the way up to Seattle Federal Building. And I participated in the Native American church. My mom was not happy with me. The AIM song was our anthem. And I learned it on the big drum, which I helped carry. It was the first traditional song I learned because I was kicked out of the longhouse. I used to have to sit and listen to my elders all too often, Moses P. Shaway. He was a Vietnam vet sent to war at the age of 17, who came home more traumatized than ever because the VA would not acknowledge his complex PTSD. He self-medicated with alcohol and cigarettes all of his adult life. He was the son of Minnie Shaway, Minnie Wesley Shaway, and he helped raise me. Moses would tell me to go howl at the moon with him as he banged on his trash can singing the old chief song. He understood a lot of languages, Chinook, Latin, Wasco, Sahaptin, because his dad, Abe Shaway, was a fluent speaker of them. Abe was a map maker for the Army Corps of Engineers, and he and many traveled with their delegates to designate our shared usual and accustomed sites from Celilo to Cascade Locks on both sides of the river. My allotment where I currently live is less than an acre passed down to me from Moses Shaway. It's not much. It's enough to connect me to my ancestors and the land we come from. The matriarchs and my family were leaders in the Celilo Longhouse before the flooding of the falls. In The Last Salmon Feast, a short documentary on the Celilo YM people, the Oregon Historical Society shared footage that depicted the way of life of the Celilo YM before the dam changed everything. My great-grandmother, Minnie Wesley Shaway, was named and recorded in the documentary as the leader of the woman folk, given her place of honor. I was taught how to gather roots and the first foods of my people from traditional food gatherers, anybody who would teach me. For the Celilo YM and many other regional river tribes, bands, and nations, food sovereignty is sacred and carries our songs and ceremony. That is what my people have died for. My mother was fluent in her language before she went to the boarding school. After, she never spoke her language, and she never grew her hair long again. Both of my parents were survivors of boarding residential schools. They never spoke of their experiences. Heinous crimes were committed against Indian children, their families, and their communities during this tragic era. This is the hour of acknowledgement. These crimes must be talked about, but it is not without pain for our elders. We need to protect their hearts and their stories. I say none of this to offend my beloved elders. Their locked away stories are invaluable and cherished. Our elders can help us all to heal. Salila Falls is not dead. My ancestor is very much alive. She's just filled with toxins. The fish are dying in this river. The fish and our other sacred foods are intrinsic to our existence. We are imprinted into our mother's memory. We are hers by song, by name, by language. The Salila Wayam are becoming extinct right before your eyes. And this is what the government wants, so they can have whatever is left of our land and resources. They have made us non-existent. Reparations are in order, but we cannot be reconciled to a nation that never wanted us here. We have been subjected to unsafe drinking water all this time. The Army Corps built a new water tower worth millions. The water inside remains the same, unsafe. We have new windows, but the sprinkler from my garden has covered the entire backside of my house with a white film. Recently, the tower ran out of water, and inside we discovered organic matter, red in color. My son got spinal meningitis when he was a baby after consistent ear infections. He became deaf because of the bacteria in the water. I traveled to Standing Rock as a prayer warrior. We were called protesters. Water is life, we chanted, Mini Wachoni. In the Lakota language, it rang throughout the village day and night. I danced with the butterfly fan. As a jingle dress healer, they maced us, and people were shot with rubber bullets and doused with ice water in below freezing temperatures. I have complex PTSD from the violence we experienced. It was war. We are in war still. Premature death stalks us. My brother Lonnie's last words before he passed away recently were, keep doing the work. I've been in service to our needs as the river people for almost 10 years. I have cried every day for my people. People in the village thought that my great-grandmother was a witch. She spoke in tongues and was a healer, using the knowledge of our traditional medicines that never got passed down. People paganized her way of being and knowing. My mother taught us girls to bead so we could go to the drive-in. Once I peered into her bead box and asked her, what is that? She said, those are beaver balls, the testicles of a beaver. Her granny used them to pray for women with fertility issues. We are the Beaver Clan as much as we are the Salmon people. I had a stroke a year ago. I thought I was just having a blood sugar low. I'm diabetic. So I made myself a meal, took a spirit plate, and offered it to my granny's home site at Salila Park. Then I got there. I was walking to the point of the eddy. I noticed an eagle flying overhead. It flew really low to the ground, so I raised my phone to take a photo and suddenly got hit with a dizzy spell. I began to truck back to my SUV. As I was walking, I noticed a walking stick that had been chewed on by beavers, and I picked it up. A few steps later, I fell into the river. It was windy, and I couldn't move. It felt like there was an elephant sitting on my chest. As the waves crashed over me, I thought, Jesus, is this how I die, really? And then I heard a voice command, geared up. So I dug my new walking stick into the rocks until it became stable enough for me to walk, pulling myself hand over hand up the stick. I stood, swaying hard back and forth when I heard the deep tone said, pick it up. I could barely stand. I reached down to pick up the waterlogged stick. The log was covered with visible faces of beavers, the mama, the papa, and the babies. I returned a week later to thank the beavers. I sang them their own song. I love you, beaver, beaver, beaver. Come say hi, beaver, beaver, beaver. They came out with the message that benzene is killing them and that the Columbia River is polluted beyond livability and to clean it up now. My ancestors said it all along. Our river will die. Today, this is more true than ever. Every spring, the beaver dies on the highway. It crushes me. Today, I am a beaver. Believer, their existence is parallel to ours. They have been brought to their brink of extinction and have survived. They call us crazy, like St. Thomas, because we could hear from the other realms in which our Wyatt can live. We have been portrayed as heathens because of our connection, our traditions, our ceremonies. But that's what gives us our strength and our resilience to keep going, keep fighting. I am so done with fighting. I'm about the healing journey, truth and reconciliation. But I will speak up and speak out on behalf of our people. We are not just somebody's sad story like the falls. We are still here. We love, we live. We fish, we pick, we dig, we sing, we dance. I know who I am. I am a woman of integrity and honor. I am Salalo I am and Coast Elish. And I won't stop speaking up until my people have their rights back and we are our own nation as promised in the 1855 treaty. Able to see our own affairs, resources, people, land, and water. I believe in our lifetime, the river will run natural again, and we will be there.
We'll be right back.
Rotary 10 by REM here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. That followed part two of a reading by Lana Jack. You can find the first part featured in the May 22nd, 2023 episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour at kboo.fm. Up next, Norm Diamond reviews two Portland productions, a dance performance by the Northwest Dance Project, and a play at Portland Center Stage. Here's Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is Norm Diamond with an unusual episode of Another World is Possible. Coming out of the pandemic fog, I've seen a couple of performances recently that are worth calling to your attention. One that's already happened, and even if you can't any longer see it, is still worth knowing about, and another that's just starting up and will be playing from now into July. The first was a remarkable modern dance performance by the Northwest Dance Project. The second, a joyous and novel presentation of Shakespeare's play, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Both had interesting and affirmative political visions. The Northwest Dance Project performance integrated a political understanding that all by itself would be familiar to listeners of the Old Mole Variety Hour, but was unexpected for an audience of generally older, white attendees able to pay the ticket prices in the city's prestigious Performing Arts Center, and was extraordinarily well done. The program consisted of two choreographed dances to two compositions by Russian-born composer Igor Stravinsky, The Rite of Spring and Petrushka. The Rite of Spring was beautifully danced, as was Petrushka, but the latter brought something more, an ongoing narrative and commentary integrated with the music that's quickly dispensed with the conventional story of a puppet's unrequited love. After that, the dancer slash narrator went on to address Stravinsky's fascist leanings and support for Mussolini, all as part of the dance. She interpreted some of the newly choreographed movements as they happened as a response to, quote, the horrors of late capitalism. She initiated a discussion of racism by telling how one of the characters in Petrushka has been danced in blackface in the United States all through the 20th century and as recently as 2015 in Florida. The presentation of A Midsummer Night's Dream at Portland Center Stage didn't add any words to what Shakespeare wrote, but did something else to challenge the play's conventions and provide new insights, in particular, into its sexual politics. Underlying the fanciful plot, if you remember the story, is an extreme version of paternal authority. By law, in the fictional Athens where the play is set, a daughter must marry the man her father chooses or be put to death. It's that law, and a father's insistence that it be enforced, that drives the young lovers into the forest where all the merriment and confusion the play is known for ensue. The starting point for the gaiety, in other words, is Shakespeare's exposure and critique of patriarchy and rigid, unfair laws. Gendered, unequal power in relationships is a repeated motif. The fairy queen and king fight over an orphan she's adopted and wants to raise. The king wants this little boy instead as a servant. Through brutal trickery, he gets his way. I've seen the play staged with a full-on emphasis on sexual violence. Even without that extreme interpretation, A Midsummer Night's Dream is a play about sexual politics, about who decides, who can be in an intimate relationship, with whom, about desire, what influences it, and its consequences, about unequal relationships, how they're negotiated, how they're resolved, and at whose expense. In broader scope, it's also a play about people acting against their own desires, against their own best interests. The explanation Shakespeare offers may be love charms or invisible fairies, but he wrote in a time when witchery was considered part of an explanation for aberrant behavior. and people, primarily women, were condemned and punished horribly for their supposed influence as witches. The play asks its characters, and directly its audience, whether everything we've seen might have been only a dream. But there's a suggestion that dreams may be liberatory, and that underlying the normality of our lives, another world is possible. That potential, what the world could be, is also a reality, one that transcends the empirical world we inhabit. Some of A Midsummer Night's Dream wisdom comes through that fanciful alternative world. It may be expressed by fairies, invisible representatives of the natural world, but it speaks to and for all of us. The exploitive relations of our society, what they call our dissensions, have consequences that undermine humanity's ability to live in the world. They cause pandemics, rivers to overflow, seasons to change. Here is Titania, the fairy queen, protesting the fairy king's domination. "Never since the middle summer's spring met we on a hill, in dale, forest, or mead, by paved fountain, or by rushy brook, or in the beached margent of the sea, to dance our ringlets to the whistling wind, but with thy brawls thou hast disturbed our sport. Therefore the winds, piping to us in vain, as in revenge, have sucked up from the sea contagious fogs, which, falling in the land, hath every pelting river made so proud that they have overborne their continents. The ox hath therefore stretched his yoke in vain. The ploughman lost his sweat, and the green corn hath rotted ere his youths attained a beard. The fold stands empty in the drowned field, and crows are fatted with the Murian flock. The nine men's morris is filled up with mud, and the quaint mazes in the wanton green, for lack of tread, are indistinguishable. The human mortals want their winter cheer. No night is now with hymn or carol blessed. Therefore the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air, that rheumatic diseases do abound. And thorough this distemperature, we see the seasons alter. The hoary-headed frosts fall in the fresh lap of the crimson rose, and on old Heim's thin and icy crown, an odorous chaplet of sweet summer buds is, as in mockery, set. The spring, the summer, the childing autumn, angry winter, change their wonted liveries, and the mazed world, by their increase, now knows not which is which. And this same progeny of evils comes from our debate, from our dissension. We are their parents and original." I mentioned that the production at Portland Center Stage adds a thoughtful new dimension to these underlying issues. In every staging I've ever seen before, the characters are either women or they're men, clearly distinct. The four couples, the three to be married, and the fairy royalty are heterosexual. In this production, while the language continues to be gendered, and as written by Shakespeare, many of the characters, but not all, are ambiguous. The result is not so much disconcerting as insightful. Patriarchy continues to be a problem, but problematic too, we now see, are unequal power dynamics within relationships more generally. This is a production worth seeing, playing at Portland Center Stage till July 2nd. And this is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
traveling by the Bins following Norm Diamond's review for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next from the archive, Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews The Taste of Ginger, Monsi Shaw's 2021 novel. Here's Patricia Kohlberg reading for Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I'm reading today a review by Book Mole Larry Bolden. Preeti Desai is a successful corporate lawyer who has, in her estimation, finally achieved the assimilation into American culture that she had striven all of her life to achieve. But then a horrible accident involving her brother and sister-in-law call her back to India, and she realizes how much she still walks like an elephant. Her mother has told her this so often. Quote, I was around 9 years old when I realized she wasn't calling me fat. She meant that I wasn't demure and obedient, qualities that every good Indian daughter should have. End quote. And so begins this fascinating, sometimes heartbreaking story of an Indian family that has immigrated to the U.S. and parents who desperately want their two children to assimilate and succeed as Americans, but also want them to retain Indian values and culture. Monsi Shaw, with her incisive and lovely prose, lays out this story in her 2021 novel, A Taste of Ginger. Preeti has not talked to her mother for months. Quote, not since she found out that my boyfriend, now ex-boyfriend, and I had been living together in Los Angeles, cohabiting with a Doria was, in her opinion, the most shameful thing her daughter could have done. Living with a white boy was right up there with marrying someone from a lower caste or talking back to your elders. End quote. Preeti and her brother Neil have been striving since childhood to slough off Indian clothes and habits in order to succeed in this new home in Chicago. Quote, despite living in America for over 20 years, my parents didn't have any friends who weren't Gujarati, much to my chagrin as a teenager trying to fit into this new country. Devon Avenue gave my parents the option of living in the West without giving up the East and expecting their children to do the same. End quote. When her brother and pregnant sister-in-law are seriously injured in a rickshaw truck accident in India, Preeti must fly, quote-unquote, home, although she risks losing her job at the law firm where she works 60-plus hours a week. And there she finds that as an NRI, or non-resident Indian, she is as singled out and as foreign as she has been in the United States. Unlike in Los Angeles, in India she looks the same as those around her, but is immediately set apart. Having been born in a higher caste, her family had lived a relatively wealthy life in India, with servants to care for their daily needs. In America, her engineer father is not recognized for the educated man he is and must take on what for him is menial labor. It is not until she returns to India that she really realizes how much her parents had given up to come to America. Neither had she really understood the Indian caste system, which she is forced to recognize when she has the audacity to associate with an Indian photographer who is of a lower caste. And finally, she did not realize that her mother had been unhappy in this country, yearning for her old life in India, but unwilling to go back. Quote, as an immigrant child of immigrant parents, I grew up knowing my future had to be their future. That meant getting the best grades, going to the best college, and getting the best job to ensure the sacrifices they had made for us were validated. End quote. While her brother Neil has also had to work hard to assimilate, he has been able to retain some core Indian values. He marries a very traditional Indian woman who seems to easily balance the two cultures. Preeti admires but also resents their apparent ease in reverting to Indian values. You guys, Preeti says to them, are among the lucky few that have a love marriage that fell within the biodata matches of the arranged system, and you have to protect it. You have to give me hope that someday, somewhere, I will be able to find that kind of happiness too. End quote. Although her sister-in-law survives the accident, the baby does not, and it turns out that Preeti must stay in India much longer than intended to help her beloved brother reunite with his grief-stricken wife. Shaw develops her story and her characters slowly with a keen eye and forgiving heart. Over the time there, Preeti finally manages to reconnect with her mother and to realize how she has struggled in her American life. She also comes to understand how limited her knowledge of the caste system is. Quote, "During my Indian childhood and infrequent trips back, I had never had occasion to be around anyone from another caste outside of servants and vendors, and I wasn't familiar with the differences in lifestyle between them. It hadn't occurred to me that there were public schools here, because I'd only known people who went to private ones. What I knew of India applied only to the upper caste, and I realized I knew nothing of how most of the country lived." End quote. This is a really lovely and insightful novel. Eventually, Preeti concludes that even arranged marriages have their advantages. I have been talking about Mansi Shah's novel, The Taste of Ginger. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kullberg, reading today for Larry.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for June 12, 2023. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg and Larry Bolden, Norm Diamond and Lana Jack, and to Bill Resnick and his guest, Harry Fetter. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.